As I said yesterday, our topic for today is God. And what we want to do is we want to look as extensively as possible into what the Old Testament has to tell us about God, how and what God is revealing to us about himself. And to do that, there are lots of different places to start, but at least from an academic standpoint, probably one of the places which provides the best entry into looking at how God reveals himself to people is through the names of God that are found in the Old Testament. Now, there's lots of words that are actually used to refer to God in the Old Testament. But there are two main words that are used to refer to God. One is El, and the other one is Yahweh. And I want to begin simply by introducing these. We will spend more time talking about them later. But they are very different in nature, and I'll say this again later. El is sort of a general term for God. It translates God, but it is kind of a general term for God. And actually, the word El and the word Allah in Arabic have the same basic meaning or the same basic root. And if you are not aware of it, Arabic and Hebrew actually are what are called cognate languages. That is to say, they both come from a one basic root, even though the languages have developed in completely different ways and different characteristics. But there are words that are the same or very similar in both languages. For instance, in Hebrew, the word for peace and for greeting somebody and things like that is shalom. And in Arabic, the equivalent word is salam. And again, because they have the same root that the language originally developed from. And in Hebrew, the singular form of the word God is El, and in Arabic, the singular form is Allah. Now, later on, we might discuss, okay, what's the difference between the God of the Israelites and the Allah of the Arab people? Because there are some vast different characteristics, and as understood in the Muslim world today, Allah and the God of the Christians and Jews, in my opinion, are two totally different gods and not the same. But in terms of El, let me say El is kind of like an office. So you can talk about the president, or Mark is the dean of the seminary. You can talk about the dean, or you can talk about Mark. I have been associated with the seminary in one way or another almost since the day it began. And I have known several different deans of academics here at the seminary. And each one of them, while they were in that office, were known as dean. So today, Mark is the dean. And the word dean refers to the office that he holds. El is kind of like that. Now, the personal name of the dean is not Dean, it is Mark, or Mark Nelson. And so that's the personal name, and that's what Yahweh signifies. It's the personal name of God. Think of it as kind of the first name. So that's the main difference between El and Yahweh. And so El is what I would call just a generic, general word that says God. If you were an ancient Egyptian and you were referring to one of the ancient Egyptian gods, let's say the great god of the Egyptians in ancient time was Amun-Ra, then Amun-Ra would be El, God. Actually, Amun-Ra would be the personal name. In the Canaanite world, you read about the god Baal. Baal was the, you might say, the storm god, the thunder god, the supreme god of the Canaanites. Baal, you could talk about as El, which is to say the supreme god, or you could talk about the personal name of that god, which was Baal. And so it's important to understand the rather dramatic distinction between El and Yahweh. El is simply kind of a generic, general form, just saying God, and not designating anything specific about the personal nature of that particular God. But in terms of God, there are certain things that any God is believed to actually be and do. So a God is very powerful, much more so than humans. A God does not dwell on earth, but a God dwells in some place. In the ancient world, a God was represented usually by a statue, and that statue was an idol. A God usually had people who honored and worshiped that particular God. And these are but a few of the many characteristics that would be associated with the word God. And likewise, these are then characteristics associated with El. Now, when you come to Yahweh, Yahweh was the unique personal name of God revealed to the Israelites. And as the unique personal name of God revealed to the Israelites, there were other characteristics that were associated with this. Not only was Yahweh powerful, but Yahweh was all-powerful. Yahweh was the creator. He was the one that the Israelites worshiped, nobody else. He was the one who gave the Israelites their law, what we call the Ten Commandments, as well as the other laws in the Old Testament. He was the one who saves the Israelite people. He is the one who supports them when they are attacked. And the list can go on and on and on. These are things specifically associated with Yahweh, and not just the generic, general name for God. So, with that kind of beginning explanation, let's take a look at the names of God that we see in the Old Testament. And these will help kind of broaden our understanding of the idea that the Old Testament gives us about God, but also about this special God, and that God is Yahweh. Now, I need to start by saying that as far as we can tell, in Old Testament times, people believed that there were many gods. And you kind of heard a little bit of that in what I've already been saying about El and Yahweh and Baal and Amun-Ra. Today, we in the Western world, we in the Christian world, believe that there is one and only one God. And that one God is the God of the Jews and Christians. And the important thing to realize is, in the ancient world, every different nation had one or more gods, usually multiple gods, that they honored and worshiped and looked to for help. And because of this system and this interconnection between their gods, this became a really powerful influence in the way in which they carried out all of their activities. So, for instance, if they went to war with another nation, the first thing they did was to ask the priests to make sacrifices and offerings on behalf of the nation to their God, so that their God would give them victory in war. And that way they felt like their God then would be more powerful than the enemy's God, and so they would triumph in the war. And you see this in several different situations in the Old Testament. One of the rather interesting stories is the story of a prophet. This is when the Israelites were still in the wilderness, and they wanted to go through the land of Moab. Now, if you look at Israel, you'll see that Israel looks a little bit like this, with the Dead Sea here and the Sea of Galilee here and the Jordan River. In the ancient world, Moab was located down here, and Ammon was located further north. And the Israelites were in the Sinai Desert down here, and they wanted to go through the land of Moab before going into the traditional homeland of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is what we call Israel. And so the people of Ammon and Moab were cousins of the Israelites. If you go way back to the time of Abraham, the Ammonites and the Moabites were descended from Abraham's family. And so the Israelites sent a message to the king of Moab requesting permission to go through the land. And so peaceably go east of the Jordan River and then eventually enter into the land of Canaan. The king of Moab said, uh-uh, you may not go through my land. Because he knew if he did allow them to do that, that he would then have problems with his neighbors. And so the Israelites and the Moabites lined up getting ready to go to war. But the king of Moab wanted to be sure that he was going to have the upper hand. So he sent for a prophet of God who was located up east of the Sea of Galilee. This man apparently had a very, very well-known reputation as a prophet of God, the real God, our God. And he was so well-known that centuries after this event occurred, there was some kind of a memorial inscription to him that was erected in this particular area. And how we know that is that about 15 years ago, archaeologists actually discovered that memorial inscription bearing his name and honoring him for being a prophet of God. Well, to make sure that the king of Moab would triumph over the Israelites, he did not want just to rely on the gods of the Moabites, but he wanted to go all the way to the top. And so he had this prophet of God to come down to Moab to curse the Israelites before the war broke out. And so it's an interesting story if you read it. What actually happens is that on the way down, the prophet falls off of his donkey more than one time, and he gets really mad at the donkey, and finally, he beats the donkey to get it to move and things like that, and it won't. And finally, the donkey speaks to the prophet. You may remember the story now. The donkey speaks to the prophet and says, "Why are you beating me? Don't you see the angel standing on the road in front of me? I cannot go anywhere." And then God says to the prophet that he is to repeat only the words that God gives him whenever he stands up to fulfill his contract with the king of Moab. And so then he continues on, he goes down to Moab, and the king of Moab takes him out to a mountain overlooking where the Israelites were camped and says, "Now curse the Israelites." And so he says, "Okay," and he opens his mouth, and instead out comes blessings on the Israelites. And the king of Moab says, "What are you? I bring you here to curse my enemy and you bless them." And he says, well, you know, I have to say what God gives me, but let's try it again tomorrow. And so tomorrow they come out, and he blesses the Israelites again. And it happens one more time, and the king of Moab is just really, really upset. And so the prophet says, well, I can only say, when I stand in that way to pronounce words over your enemies, I can only say what God gives me. But he said, I can tell you how to bring them under the curse of God. And then he explains to the king, let your sons marry their daughters and let your daughters marry their sons. And by doing that, it will make God very unhappy with them. And then he will curse them because of that. And the king of Moab says, oh, well, okay. And so after that, the prophet apparently continued for the rest of his life, which may not have been very long, to live in the land of Moab and never returned back to his former area. But the idea of telling you this story is to illustrate the way in which the God-human type of interaction occurred in the ancient world, or at least how it was thought. About two centuries later, you see another story of a similar nature in the Old Testament. This is in the books of Samuel. And now Israel has a king named Saul. And the Israelites are under attack by a group of people known as the Philistines. And while they are under attack by the Philistines, the army of Israel has been pushed all the way to the Jordan River for safety. And they are gathered around and they are waiting for Saul to lead them in an attack on the Philistines. And the Philistines have taken over all of their cities and are controlling the countryside where all the people live. And so they gather at the Jordan River and they wait. 1 day, 2 days, Samuel told Saul, wait until I come and I will offer sacrifices to God and then you can go up against the Philistines. Well, after 4 days, Samuel does not come and people begin to worry. And by the fifth day, they say, maybe Samuel is not coming. Or maybe a lion ate him. Or maybe he fell into a deep valley and he injured himself and died. Or maybe the Philistines got him. And the fifth day, Samuel does not come and the people are worried. The sixth day, he does not come and they are now getting really upset, and they're beginning to leave the area to go back home and at least defend their homes. You can imagine how Saul was feeling. He's waiting there, waiting for God, waiting for Samuel, waiting for something to happen. You probably know how that feels because you have probably waited for something to happen at some time in your life, and it's taken a lot longer than you felt comfortable. Well, on the seventh day, finally, Saul had enough. Saul is going to offer the sacrifices to God himself. And so the animals that were brought down with the people to the Jordan River for the sacrifice, they had to be of a particular character, a particular quality. It could not be just any animal. And so Saul takes the animals that Samuel would have used for sacrifice, at least some of them, and they have an altar there, and he leads the sacrifice on the altar himself. And just as he is wiping the knives off and cleaning up from the sacrifice, here comes Samuel. And Saul says, "Where have you been? We've been waiting for you all these days." And Samuel looks at Saul and says, "Saul, what have you done?" "Well, we didn't know if you were even still alive. We did not know if you were going to come or not. And so I forced myself, and we offered the sacrifice to God." And in one of the really dramatic moments in the Old Testament, Samuel says, "Saul, don't you know to obey is better than sacrifice?" Well, I'm going to stop the story there because it already illustrates what I want you to see. You see, to Saul, what was important was to satisfy the people's God before going to war. For Samuel, the sacrifice was a very different kind of a situation. But in Saul's mind, and in the popular mind, you had to satisfy your God first, so that your God would give you the victory. This is the way people in the ancient world, in most of the Old Testament period, this is the way they understood the world. And it is important to put yourself into that world. You do not have to accept it as your own, but you have to put yourself into that world to see and understand what the people then felt and understood in order to analyze and to look more deeply into what the Old Testament says about God and how he reveals himself to the people. So in that time period, every war, if you want to think of it this way, was a holy war. It was not just a war between this group of people and this group of people. It was a war between the God of these people and the God of these people. And when the war was over, the people that won, now their God was widely known as the greater God, at least for then, between the two peoples. And so this was the way that it was understood. We don't think of life, we don't think of the world as organized in that way today. But in the ancient world, this was how it was understood. And not just with the Moabites or just with the Philistines, but even centuries later when the Assyrians would attack the Israelites, or the Babylonians would attack the Israelites, or the Persians subdued the Babylonians, Or even later when the Greeks overcame the Persians or the Romans prevailed. In the ancient world, people saw not just the power of the kingdoms and the empires, but they saw the power of the gods of those people as being expressed through the victories that that particular group of people won. So it's very, very important to put yourself in that world and to realize that in the Old Testament period, for most of the Old Testament period, people believed there were many gods. Now, when I say they believed there were many gods, that does not mean that they honored and worshiped those gods. They simply believed that there were other gods besides their own God. And with the exception, perhaps, of the Israelites, they simply thought of the gods as essentially equals. Just like when we look at each other, we don't think of one person as the greatest and most powerful and another person as really below us and beneath us and we can step on them. But we talk about a general equality between one human and another. That was more or less the way the ancient people saw their gods and the interaction between the gods in some kind of an unseen, invisible realm. And the people believed this was the way in which the world worked. And you see this expressed in poems and songs in honor of their gods. You see it expressed in all kinds of writings in honor of their gods. I talked yesterday about the fact that there are writings that predate Moses by as much as 2,000 years or more. Those writings basically either talk about events that happened under a particular king, or they talk about a particular king, or they are in some way related to praise for one or more of the national gods of the people. And one of the earliest references to El that is known, and this is where we'll break, one of the earliest references to El that is known is actually from an excavation that was done in northern Syria at a site called Ebla. And it dates to about 2200 to 2400 BC. And it was a huge library of information, and one of the things it contained was a hymn or a poem in honor of El. And El is referred to as the creator god, and in very many ways resembles the God of the Israelites that we meet in the Old Testament. So the idea of the God El was not unique to the Israelites, but was uniquely related with the Israelites. And that's a good spot for us to take a break, so let's take a break, and then when we come back, we'll pick up from there.